Chris.
Great. Yeah, I have to say that after all the things that Jonathan was mentioning, certainly supervising his research was the most pleasurable. So anyway, I would like to talk today about the role of magnetic fields in star formation. And my outline is, first I wanted to start off with an historical introduction, talking about the relative roles of magnetic fields in gravity. And then talk about observation of the magnetic field. There's a very prominent paper that Dick Crutcher and his colleagues wrote summarizing all the Zeeman observations that were available as of 2010. And then we actually, we being Peck Shing Li, Richard Klein, and myself, managed to reanalyze, look at their data again and get a new result. Then we went ahead and did a simulation and essentially repeated these observations but on the computer. And one of the points that I'm going to emphasize is that the observed fields are weighted by the mass through which you're observing if you're doing Zeeman observations, whereas oftentimes you're interested in what the volume-weighted field is. And we find that the observed mass-weighted fields are actually greater than the volume-weighted fields. Then I'll talk about the protostellar accretion disk crisis, which has been with us for some years. Then just in terms of the title of my talk, I said the role of magnetic fields in star formation. They actually play an important role in suppressing fragmentation, but we found that they're not critical for setting the IMF. But unfortunately, I don't have time to go into that today.
Can you skip?
Somebody asked me about it at the end, though.
But if we asked you now. That's tricky.
Right. So. Anyway, there were the seminal theory papers were written many decades ago by Mestel and Spitzer in 56, Mestel in 65, Peter Stripmatter in 66, Lyman Spitzer in 68, and then Lushevius and Spitzer a few years later. And the key idea, one of the key ideas in these papers was that the magnetic energy scales like the gravitational energy. So if you just take the ratio of the gravitational energy to the magnetic energy, gm squared over r and b squared r cubed, you can see that you get an m squared, and then I get a b squared, bringing this r down here, I get an r to the fourth. So that's just the magnetic flux squared. So that's independent of scale. And then what that says is that the magnetic energy is equal to gravitational energy when the mass is equal to critical mass, which is proportional to the flux divided by the square root of g. So then there's a numerical coefficient in front of that, and the value I've chosen is the value that's appropriate for a magnetized sheet. So if you have a sheet with a magnetic field perpendicular to it. And then it turns out that's also appropriate if you're looking at a more complicated geometry and look at the central flux tube. So then there are two classical problems in star formation that were realized, again, decades ago. First is the magnetic flux problem, and there are actually two parts to this magnetic flux problem. Mestel and Spitzer asked, how is it possible that you can have, if you look at how much the effects of magnetic field in the interstellar medium exceed those of gravity. So how is it possible that you can get enough mass together so that it can exceed this critical mass and allow gravitational collapse to occur? So that's the first problem. There's actually a problem in terms of orders of magnitude, which is much, this is a factor of a few problem. This problem is many, many orders of magnitude, which is that when you actually look at stars, you find that the magnetic flux is many, many orders of magnitude smaller. And that has to do with what goes on in protostellar accretion disks, and that's a separate problem that I won't discuss today. So I'm gonna be, won't be able to get into that. Then the second classic problem is the angular momentum problem. How is it possible that interstellar gas can lose the 99% of the angular momentum that it needs in order to form a star? And again, this was recognized by these, Mestel and Spitzer many years ago. So Spitzer pointed out that magnetic torques can solve the angular momentum problem. But in fact, in their earlier paper, they pointed out that maybe magnetic fields would be so strong they would prevent the formation of a disk. So in other words, they predicted the protostellar accretion disk problem, you know, decades before people had even seen protostellar accretion disks. So it's the prescience in their work is just amazing. And I should say that neither of these problems are fully resolved. So let me return now to this magnetic flux problem. And I'm going to use the symbol mu sub phi to represent the ratio of the mass to the critical mass. So sometimes I just refer to that as the mass to flux ratio, since m, this magnetic critical mass, just is directly proportional to magnetic flux phi. So then this mass to flux ratio just has this coefficient in front of it times the mass to flux ratio. And we refer then to clouds that are magnetically supercritical as being the case when the gravitational energy exceeds the magnetic energy. That's mu phi is bigger than one. And that means that the cloud can collapse. On the contrary, if it's magnetically subcritical, the gravitational energy is less, and mu phi is less than one, and the cloud can't collapse. And so remember that in this, if we're assuming ideal MHD, so that the flux is conserved and the mass is conserved, then what this means is that no matter what you do to the cloud, you can have it undergo a shock and compress it by a factor of a million. If mu phi is less than one, it's still not going to collapse, even after it's compressed by this huge factor. So, and conversely, if it's greater than one, nothing you can do will prevent it from collapsing as long as you remain with ideal MHD. And one of the things about ideal MHD, which we'll talk about later, is that the mass to flux ratio can increase only due to mass flow along the field line. So in other words, if this is a magnetic field line, I can have, and if this, say, we're an initial filament, then I could have mass flow along this filament, and it could collect together into a sphere, and then I could get a supercritical cloud, and that might collapse. But there's no way that if I have parallel field lines here, then at least so long as ideal MHG is operative, you can't have mass go across the field lines. That's a non-ideal image. Yeah. Sure, you're completely correct. So there are non-ideal. In fact, I'm going to mention that even in our ideal MHD simulations, that there's evidence for non-ideal effects. So, going back to this classic paper, Mestel and Spitzer realized that the diffuse interstellar medium is magnetically subcritical, and therefore you cannot form stars. Remember, they're writing these papers prior to the discovery of molecular gas in the interstellar medium. So,
how did they know that, given that there was no measurement of the magnetic flux in the, you're coming to that?
No, but that's a good question, Rachel. So they were able to estimate the strength of the, people had estimated the strength of the field based mainly on equipartition arguments, and it was known that there, I'd say the most direct evidence for the magnetic field was the interstellar polarization of starlight, which people had attributed to polarized grains. And Davis and Chandrasekhar and Fermi wrote their papers prior to the stuff that Lyman did in the 60s. So modern 21 centimeter observations of the atomic hydrogen show that this mass to flux ratio is less than a six, so that it's definitely very subcritical. And then they showed that the length scale required for flow along the field lines is just too long to be effective in forming stars. So we can use modern data to go over their argument. So I'm going to have capital N, that'd be the column density, and that's just the density times the length of this flux tube. So what I want to know is if I have this flux tube in the interstellar medium, how long does this tube have to be in order to be able to bring together enough mass so that I can have a mass to flux ratio that is greater than one? And so we just write this mass to flux ratio in terms of mu phi with this constant in front. And the mass is just the column density times the mass per particle times the area, and the flux is the magnetic field times the area, so the areas cancel out. And we now get a relation in which we have the length scale on one side and the mass to flux ratio on the other, so we can solve for the length scale. And when you put in the numbers, this is the typical field strength that Hylas and Trolin measured in the diffuse interstellar medium. And it's five, to get a mass to flux ratio of one, you have to go 500 parsecs for a typical mean density of one particle per cc. And in fact, to be supercritical, then you want this bigger. So you're going to have to go more than half a kiloparsec. So that's huge. And the amazing.
Is there evidence for mu increasing as you go from the denser point clouds? When they measure mu as a function of density, say?
Okay, this is, what I'm saying is that if I start off with a typical interstellar medium, how much do I have to, how long is the flux tube? And you're right, as the flux tube, as I get to shorter and shorter length, then the density will go up and I get dense. But I had to start from the in a typical diffuse interstellar medium with this very long length scale.
But observationally, when you say mu is less than 6 in H1, can they break that up as a function of density and C trend?
That's the median value. So they've not, to my knowledge, they've not tried to analyze it. I'll get back to the, at least in terms of the magnetic field strength, we'll see more about that later. So this length scale, in fact, is the length scale that is associated with the formation of GMCs. And this was done 20 years before GMCs were discovered. So what they then did is they said, well, it's impossible to make stars, but of course stars are forming. So just as you mentioned, they said that it must be due to ambipolar diffusion. In other words, you have the motion of the neutrals through the ions, because it's only the ions that are coupled to the magnetic field. And in fact, as many of you probably remember, this then became the standard theory for star formation. And this is a picture out of the classic review article by Frank Shu and Fred Adams and Susanna Lozano. And they argued that basically that this was the right mechanism and allowed the gas to evolve from being subcritical to supercritical. However, as we shall see, there's actually no evidence for any subcritical gas in the molecular phase. So, okay, so let's now talk about some of the observations. And as I mentioned, Dick Crutcher and his collaborators wrote a seminal paper where they collected all the existing Zeeman observations and analyzed them. And these Zeeman observations are extremely difficult to make, so that they're very heterogeneous. You can't go out and do a big survey because it takes many, each, my understanding is each observation is a major tour de force. And so what they're measuring then is they get the product of the column density times the magnetic field, the line of sight magnetic field, and it's mass weighted. I'm going to use, sometimes I say density weighted, sometimes mass weighted, but basically I'm just integrating along the line of sight, and since I'm looking at a molecular line, I'm going to get the product of the line of sight field times the density. And so if we then let this B subtotal be the magnitude of the mass weighted total field before projection. So if the magnetic field is like this, then any observer is going to just see the component of the, you know, along your line of sight. So the line of sight is the value you see, and the total is what you would like to infer. Then since the average value of cosine theta is 1/2, that means that the average value of this total field is just twice the line of sight field. So on a statistical basis, you can infer the total field. So then I remind you that the atomic gas is magnetically subcritical, but molecular clouds are supercritical. So I actually argued that many years ago. That was just based on theory, so you could take that. I took it very seriously, but you know, observers, observers might want to say, well, you know, where's the proof? Well, so Dick Crutcher in 1999 summarized the data as of that point and showed that the cores typically do have mass to flux ratios bigger than one. He also showed that the alpha and Mach number was of order unity as well. Then Trollen and Crutcher in a larger article looking at OH observations found that the mu sub phi was between about 1.7 and 2.6, and their median alpha and Mach number was again of order unity a little bit.
Excuse me, so that is your theory also applicable to molecular cloud cores, not to the giant molecular clouds?
Yeah, so these are observations of limited regions. As I'll mention in a minute, the largest region had a mass of somewhat over 1,000 solar masses. So observations, there have been observations made of GMCs as a whole by Tom Trolland, and he reported them at an EPAS meeting like 6 years ago, but he told me he was going to publish the paper this summer, but but we have to still, I'm still waiting.
So the questions you mentioned, that H1 gas is so the subcritical, so the, and the evolution from the subcritical to supercritical is just by the flow along the magnetic field line.
That is, in the case of ideal MHT, that's true.
From atomic to molecular flow, so that, how do you think?
Yeah, so
it should be ideal for that.
Yeah, although as I'll mention that, in fact, there could be non-ideal processes going on associated with turbulence.
Mm, okay.
Oops, wait, did I? Yeah, okay. Then this is a diagram that they prepared. So this is the line of sight magnetic field in microgauss, and here's the density. This goes from 10 up to 10 to the 7th. And they have actual measurements, and then but you can see a lot of lines go down there. Actually, about 2/3 of the cases are just upper limits. So only 27 of 68 molecular cores have a more than a 2 sigma detection. So the low densities here, these are all H1. Then this patch here is almost all entirely OH, and then the high density points are CN. And they then used a sophisticated Bayesian analysis to try to infer the total field from the these line of sight fields. And for the first time, they included all the upper limits. So previously, people had just thrown out the upper limits because you didn't know what to do with them. And here they included those. And their principal result was that once you get above this about a few hundred, where they've drawn this line here, they find that the magnetic field increases as a density to the 0.65 power.
So does this rely on some standardized geometry for the field then, in their Bayesian analysis?
No. It's just projections, so it's just random orientations in the sky. You don't need any.
Assuming the number of reversals in any given plot.
This is the vector magnetic field. So if there were reversal, then that would cancel out. They can only, they're just saying if you see the field, if I have some this way and some that way, you're going to get a lower field value. But that's your line of sight field. They're then going to convert that to what you'd be if you were able to look at it along the field direction.
You know, if it looped around, then.
This is integrated over a telescope beam.
Yeah.
Transition from subcritical to supercritical must happen somewhere between now and then.
That's right. Yeah, so this is, in fact, it's around here that it makes that transition.
And all the points here.
Yeah, okay, so I want, yeah, so these points, by and large, these are subcritical. This is, the question was asked earlier, what happens in the diffuse gas? So basically, in the diffuse gas, the magnetic field is about constant. So gravity is not important. Once you get up here, so mu phi presumably is on average increasing as you go to higher density. And then when you get here, you start to get to molecular gas and it's also self-gravitating.
The line here is shows the boundary?
No, there is no, he actually had another graph, which I'm not showing, where instead of using the density, he had the column density. In that case, you can't mark where the transition is. But in this case, it's just a
okay. Maybe it's a simple question, I don't know much about this. But why are there gap in this region of one of the densities?
Okay.
I mean, there's a specific gap of points in two regions, I don't understand.
Right, it depends entirely on the tracer. This is, yeah, so this is H1 and then OH, and the OH critical density is a few thousand, so this is where you see it.
So
yeah.
And then are the even higher ones?
That's CN.
Yeah.
Which I think is all from a high mass, because unfortunately in the low mass, we cannot do the exam.
Yeah. So then the second result that they found was they tried to see what was the distribution of field strengths, and they didn't try to find the best one, but they just considered two models. One was a boxcar like this, which went from a factor F times Bmax up to Bmax. And what they found was, in fact, that they concluded that they could fit the data that way. and that the F was about 0.03, basically close to zero. So it implies that you have a very broad distribution of field strengths and that the going down to very weak fields. I should say, when in our analysis, we concluded that the data are inadequate to determine the distribution, because there's such a distortion going from the total field and projecting it that there's not enough data yet. Okay, so then, as I said, we got some new results. So rather than trying to infer the total field, we just analyzed the line of sight field. So we did something much simpler than they did. And we then did extensive numerical experiments to see how we should treat the upper limits. And we showed that basically you should treat the upper limits equally with the data. So it didn't matter how many sigma was. If I have a 1 sigma result or a 10 sigma result, I just include them all. It's sort of like stacking data. What we found then is that the line of sight field scales with the density to the 0.63. So basically it's very consistent with the result that they had inferred for the total field. And we could do something in addition though, and that is you have a direct measurement of the average value of the line of sight field. That just comes straight out of the data. And as I mentioned, the total field is just twice that. So what we can do then is find out what is the actual value of the magnetic field in molecular cores in the interstellar medium. And that is the average value. It's a direct observational determination. You can get a similar result from analyzing the boxcar distribution that Crutcher had, but that then depends upon that model for the field distribution, whereas this is just comes directly out of the data.
Please, can I ask a question?
Sure.
Because so I know that there have been a lot of debate about the Crutcher results, especially for the low mass dense cores that have been so the magnetic field has been measured with DOH.
Mm-hmm.
And DOH, well, first of all, we know that it is probably not really tracing the dense part of the dense core. So then it could be like an obvious conclusion that the mass to flux ratio is higher than expected just because the magnetic field is tracing, say, the lower density part, while the mass is actually considering the sum of the whole mass within the dense core. So I'm wondering, here if you have, this is all the work done by Tassis and other Villasi and etc.
Yeah.
So I was wondering if you have
how did they get the mass?
Right, so they estimated the mass for the tracers that they were doing. So that is, if you had a dense core and say it had both OH and CN, my understanding is that for the OH data, they said, well, this is the mass in the OH, and they didn't add in the mass in the CN.
Right.
So I wasn't going to go into the Tassis et al. Criticism, but could you ask me that? Because we do have results that are directly relevant to that.
So because chemically, OH is not supposed to trace really. Yes, I mean, it's going to be either depleted or converted in other species within the dense core. So it's hard to understand how you can link the magnetic field that you observe in OH with the magnetic field inside or within the dense core.
Well, yeah, I should have emphasized that the results for Crutcher, that this I left out my footnote down here, which is these are fields in different clouds.
Yes.
We're not saying that this is the field variation in an individual cloud.
No,
you're addressing that is, if I have a dense core with an OH envelope, then this data does not tell you what the relative field strength is.
Okay.
So it's just, these are completely different cores.
As well as the last points. The CN is also a completely different family of things.
You said might be an error, systematic error bar where these points are in density.
Yeah.
Well, they included, they allowed for a factor of two error in their analysis. Tassis and company went ahead and took data. I think they made the mistake that you were alluding to, which is they would take data looking at a given source and then look at different tracers and find out the whole range of densities that anybody had found using any source, and that gives you a huge density range, which is not really relevant. So, okay, so here we are. And okay, so now we went ahead. So basically, you know, we looked at their data and confirmed the result that the mass-weighted field does increase systematically, and is close to going like the magnetic, like the density 2/3 power, which is what you'd expect for a spherical contraction and a weak magnetic field. But the magnetic field is not weak, so. That is a little puzzling. We showed, in fact, but we can address issues like that by actually trying to simulate it. And as I mentioned, and I've been emphasizing, we're focusing on the density-weighted field. That's what we get to see. There's another technique for measuring the field that I'm not going to discuss here, which is the Davis-Chandrasekhar-Fermi method. So when I was writing this paper, I went back and actually looked at the literature, and normally it's just referred to as the Chandrasekhar-Fermi method. But it turns out they actually acknowledged Leverett Davis for having basically the same idea and publishing in advance of their results. So I refer to it as the Davis-Chandrasekhar-Fermi method. And that is basically, if you can measure the velocity dispersion and you can also measure the dispersion and the orientation of the field, you can estimate the strength of the field that way. But of course, the advantage of numerical simulations is we know exactly what the 3D field is. We don't have to do that. Now, there are many differences between the simulation and the observations. The observations are sampling clouds with a wide range of physical conditions. At the beginning, I emphasized that these observations are very challenging. So basically, is anybody got interested in a source for any reason and they spent a lot of hours looking at it, then they just put that in the pool of data. We have one simulation. Actually, we did a second one, but I'm not going to discuss the other one. But so basically, just one simulation that's relevant. And that's a huge difference. Then the observations are smoothed by the telescope beam. We went ahead and smoothed our observations too. But in the case of the observations, the distance over which the data are smooth depends on how far away the cloud is, whereas we just picked one typical number. The maximum mass on our simulation for one of our clumps was 74 solar masses, whereas in the observations, they can be more than 10 times larger than that. And so finally,
Chris, I was actually wondering about that sort of aperture effect. Why did you choose a fixed scale? Is it because the distances are similar enough that it's not a big effect? Or why didn't you include just a range of, you could put your clouds at different distances?
Yeah, you're right. We could have done that, but we decided just to take a typical one. I think there's a factor of a matter of a factor of a few.
Okay.
It's not orders of magnitude.
Yeah.
Okay, and of course the simulations do not include non-ideal effects, but Mother Nature just naturally. So the code that we use to do this is our Orion code. And the physics included is just ideal MHD and self gravity. We had periodic boundary conditions. We drive the turbulence on large scales throughout the simulation, and we first without gravity to build up a self consistent density and velocity field, and then we turn on gravity after two crossing times. We had a resolution of 512 cubed on the base grid and two levels of refinement for an effective resolution of 2048 cubed. So then to pick our parameters, we went ahead and pick very round numbers. We have a Mach number, a sonic Mach number of 10, an alphane Mach number of 1. We said the gravitational energy was approximately equal to the turbulent energy, so that's a virial parameter, which is given by this expression, which is equal to 1. And then that actually determines the mass-to-flux ratio this is the ratio you get for a turbulent box, and so it's 1.6. So that's the overall value in our simulation. And we have, so far, those are just dimensionless numbers, and how do you relate that to reality? And isothermal MHD simulations have no scale. So one scale is with self-gravity, G brings in a value. So I can go ahead and since we set this virial parameter equal to 1, this is going to give one dimensional relation. A second dimensional relation is by the temperature, and we just set the temperature equal to typical value in molecular clouds of 10 Kelvin. And the third dimensional relation is set by the line width size relation. It's observed that the interstellar medium is turbulent and that the line width scales like the square root of the size scale. And we just use the value that's observed in the interstellar medium. And so when you then use those relations and with the dimensionless parameter that I said corresponds to a cloud of mass, 3,100 solar masses, 4.5 parsecs in size, almost 1,000 per cubic centimeter. Magnetic field is 32 microgauss, and our finest resolution cell is 500 AU. And so this is a picture, half of freefall time. Freefall time is a little over a million years after the beginning of the simulation, and you can see that there's one very large filament here, and there's a lot of other filamentary structure in the cloud as well. So because we want to compare the observations, we wanted to build up a sample of clumps. So we used ClumpFind to find the cores. We merged all the cores that are closer together than 0.06 parsecs. We had 0.03 parsecs at our resolution limit, and that's because that was the smallest separation that were available in the observations. And we chose the 100 most massive cores. It turned out that the minimum mass was then about a solar mass. And for comparison with observation, we then observed these with a beam size that on average was about a third of the size of the clump. And these regions then we found to be well resolved. They all had at least 10,000 cells in them. And this is these things were very messy though. This is a picture of a typical one. It's actually a dense core that would have been observed in CN. So the density is bigger than 2 × 10⁵. The column density through there is about 10 to the 23 per a square centimeter. The mass of this is 11 solar masses, and the radius is 0.02 parsecs. And the magnetic field actually gets up to be about 20 times as large as the initial field. And then if we look at the distribution of the line of sight field from our 100 clumps and then compare that with the line of sight field that was observed by Crutcher et al., so what we've done is just taken the value of the line of sight field, we've normalized by density so we can treat all the different observations on an equal footing, and then just normalize this to the median value. So this is the distribution. The white ones are from the observations, and the gray ones are from our simulation. And as you can see, it's by no means a perfect fit. I mean, there's certainly differences. But if you do a KS test, it basically says they agree with a p-value of about 0.5. And as I mentioned before, this is amazing because the observations are extremely heterogeneous, and this is all just from one simulation. Okay, so we found then that the density scaling does agree with what Crutcher et al. Found. Remember that they found that the total field increased with the density to this alpha power with alpha 0.65. And what we found is that the time average value of alpha was 0.7 plus or minus 0.06, consistent with their results.
Hold on. I'm just wondering, is that an actual fit to those simulated points?
This alpha, this was this red line here is a fit, and it has the slope of 0.7.
Okay, and you determine the error bars. I mean, so that's from your simulation.
Yes.
And so what sets the error each individual point on top of you?
We had 100. There are 100. Well, you can see this. The error. These are our simulation points, and so the error is. How accurately.
So scattering the points. Yeah. You don't actually, since you've smeared it or whatever, you don't actually try to do any added noise to observe it. It's just straight from the simulation.
Yep. Yeah, so that's a good point. We did not add any noise to the to our data. So the median value of the line of sight field divided normalized by density was 11.9. If we can now calculate that from our simulation also, and we get 8.9, which is reasonably close to that, and for the total field, we get about twice that. So the thing to note here is that the median total field is very close to twice the median line of sight field, which is what you'd expect. We had more sources, it would have been closer. Furthermore, the simulated line of sight field is about 75% of the observed field. So remember that this was not a fit. This comes out from the fact that we set the Mach number to be 10, the alpha and Mach number to be 1, and the virial parameter to be 1, and the temperature be 10 degrees. I mean, that's what went into getting this number, whereas this number is, you know, from observation. So that, I think, is remarkably close. Okay, now I want to emphasize, and this, because Paolo brought up this paper by Tassis and company, which is very critical of the work by Crutcher et al. And one of the et al.'s was Ptolemaicus Mushavius, who has insisted for years that this index here is 0.5, even though if you look at his papers, that sort of is reached asymptotically, but for most of the evolution of the clouds, it's less than 0.5. And what we did was, and this is actually was prompted by work that Philip Mox has done at CFA, if instead of doing the density weighted field, we just look at all the points in our simulation and treat them equally, and then ask what is the magnitude of the field as a function of density, and do a fit there, we get something substantially less than 0.65. So there's a big difference between doing the density weighted field, which is what you observe, and this volume weighted field, which in fact, if you take the volume weighted RMS field, is what the theorist is interested in, because that's what's determining the energy.
The structure of that diagram, should I think more about that structure or not? Because it sort of looks like there's sort of a high E track and a, you know, so you fit it with one slope, but there sort of looks like there's two loci in there, but maybe that's just reading too much into that.
Yeah, I think water. We did go ahead and subtract off. I was worried that maybe the points down here, because they're more numerous, were determining the answer. So we threw away the points down below and got basically the same answer.
I guess I was thinking of this sort of parallel.
Yeah. But here I'm not worrying about the height of the line as opposed to just its slope, which is substantially less than what you get from the density weighted slope.
I was also wondering, because it does look like there is a track up there.
Mm-hmm.
So is that?
Yeah. It looks like you have two different things going on in there.
Yeah.
So I guess the question are, is it? Because I don't do these calculations, and so is it, are there actually two sort of processes at work that are setting that main hub or not?
Right, that's a good question. I don't know the answer. We did not analyze that. So anyway, why is this? So there are two effects. One is that, as I've emphasized, the mass-weighted field actually increases faster than the volume-weighted field. And so here we plotted the ratio of the RMS field to the mass-weighted field as a function of density, and you can see that that's falling. And the second is that the density also is different. The actual mean density is unresolved, and in the value that the observers used and we used for our clumps was you just took the observed column density in the beam and divided by twice the radius to get the sort of the observed density, whereas the actual mean density then turns out to actually have a systematic variation as a function of the density due to the fact that it's centrally concentrated. So if you go ahead, and this is just an identity, I just wrote BRMS equals BRMS, and then I multiplied and divided by all these things. And we can evaluate each of those factors. And here we just found on the previous graph that this goes like the density minus 0.15. This is the scaling we found, so that's one. Doesn't vary with density at all. And then here we found that this goes like density to the minus 0.19 to the 0.65 power. So altogether, you get that the BRMS scales like n to the 0.38, which is close to what we observed. So I think these effects are accounting for it. So what we conclude is that the observed mass-weighted field in a set of centrally concentrated clumps is larger than the RMS field, and which determines the energy, and it also has a steeper density dependence. So unfortunately, what we would like to do then is, since the observers see the mass-weighted field and the theorists want the density-weighted field, it would be nice to have a relation so you can determine one from the other. And that, we have not done yet.
Did you guys make real parameters of the clubs, including kinetic energy?
Well, we estimated the real parameters, and we as I'll show in a minute, we also did these master flux ratios.
But including the surface terms and the large scale effects of large scale field on the clubs.
What is the question?
Did you evaluate the energetics of the clumps, including the surface terms and your theorem with magnetic terms?
No. We did. I prefer to just evaluate the straight virial parameter, and it tells you basically whether the gravity is important or not, and they are self-gravitating. So
Chris, do you have any theory for why these powers come out of the way they do?
We showed that the fact that it was close to 2/3. Was consistent with the fact that we saw the overall cores were contracting in an approximately spherical way, in the sense that the aspect ratio was within a factor of 2 of unity, and that did not change with density as they evolved. So they could be clumped, like Jonathan's saying, they're evolving in shape and so forth, but there is a quasi-spherical contraction going on. And as I said, if you have a spherical, homologous spherical contraction, we'll give you 2/3. Why it stays spherical, I don't know, because the field is not weak. And so you might think that it would tend to flow along field lines. Okay. So now we want to get the mass to flux ratio is critical. We want to see what is the actual value. And so we have to take into account the projection effects. And this is something that observers have been aware of for a long time. So let me just quickly go through this, that the mass to flux ratio then is proportional, if you just divide out the area, to the surface distance divided by the magnetic field. And what the observers get is the line of sight value of that. So they see the line of sight surface density and the line of sight magnetic field. So first, if we look at a spherical cloud, then we want to know what is the surface density divided by the field. For a spherical cloud, it doesn't matter what angle you look at it. So the surface density can be equal to line of sight surface density. And for constant density, so I don't get any extra weighting, then the a median magnetic field is going to be twice the line of sight value. So what that says is that the actual median value of the mass to flux ratio is half the value that you measure. And so, like I say, observers have known that. Then they consider the opposite limit. Instead of a spherical cloud, what if you imagine that the cloud collapsed into a sheet along the field? And so then what you want to do is you want to measure this table now is the sheet, I want to measure the surface density normal to that sheet. So that's the sigma I want to measure. On the other hand, if you're observing at an angle, you can see that when this ray goes through the table, it's actually going to get a bigger surface density. So the median of the perpendicular surface density is only half the median of the line of sight one, because the line of sight one being bigger because you're getting that projection. And then you still have the median field having the same relation as it did before. So now I get 2 factors of 2, and altogether the actual mass to flux ratio could, in this case, would be 1/4. So basically what observers have said is that for constant density clouds that are either spherical or flattened along the magnetic, I said flattened perpendicularly, I should have said, yeah, there's B is perpendicular to the sheet, then the actual mass to flux ratio, the median value, is between 1/4 and 1/2 of the observed one. Okay, so recall that what I just said. So we have that the actual value is 1/4 to 1/2 the observed one. The Crutcher et al. Found, if you just look at their sample, the median value of this is about 4, so the actual median is between 1 and 2. So based on this work, we conclude that if they are of constant density, then they're somewhat magnetically supercritical. And indeed, there are none of the OH cores and only one of the CN cores are subcritical based on the line of sight field and the line of sight surface density. So if, then with Trolin and Crutcher, they actually had a somewhat higher value of the in their sample, which was a subset, actually, of the Crutcher sample. And they got, this was the mass to flux ratio in their sample, and therefore the actual one would be between 1.3 and 2.6. And I think based on that, people have said it's typically around 2.
So field reversals, as we mentioned before, could change this. In your simulation, you have, they're all accounted for, are they?
That's right. And so what we did is we calculated the mass to flux ratio both ways, that is using the vector B and using the magnitude of B. And we found that it made almost no difference.
So in your simulation, in our fields are not reversing.
That's right. In the inner, in this inner part of the cloud. Remember that we took a telescope beam and it was like one third of the size of the cloud. Okay. So then we can determine now if we, I'm going to allow for the actual case where the density varies, then the actual value of the mass to flux ratio, it depends on the ratio of these surface densities and the magnetic fields times the observed line of sight value. And so what we find is that the mass-weighted line of sight field compared to the area-weighted magnetic field is 0.8, not 0.5. Remember, if I was just using in the constant density case, then you get a factor of 0.5. Here, it's not that way. And that's basically due to the same effect we found before, that this mass-weighted field is larger than the either volume-weighted or area-weighted one. Then it turns out that the clouds are almost spherical, so that is not a very big effect. So what we find is that the actual median value of the mass-to-flux ratio is 70% of the line-of-sight value, not 25 to 50%, and as a result, we conclude that for the Crutcher-Dahl sample, the actual value is 3, not someplace between 1 and 2. So they are, our conclusion then is that these molecular cloud cores are significantly magnetically supercritical. Okay, and then I wanted to mention in connection with non-ideal effects that there is a possible violation of flux freezing, and the you know, fragmentation can reduce the mass to flux ratio on a flux tube, but no process can increase it. But what we find is that our simulated cores, which are typically like 0.05 parsecs, they can have a mass to flux ratio of up to 23, and two-thirds of them are above the initial value for the whole box. So in other words, if I imagine initially I started off my field line, it was in the Z direction, they were all uniform, and I have gas along this flux tube. So I can imagine fragmenting it, and maybe I make, say, 3 fragments. What that would do is make the mass to flux ratio would go down. It would be, you know, start off at 1.6, and each of these fragments would then be a third of that, which would be like a half. So I could go down. What we find is instead that when I look at one of my fragments, it has a bigger mass to flux ratio. So there are two possible possibilities. One is that it's just numerical resistivity. So we have a verified convergence for our simulations up to about halfway through the simulation. By doubling the resolution, that meant that the original calculation was like 1 million hours, and so we weren't able to go to, to 4 million hours. So we could not go to the whole thing. But basically, at least the evidence we have suggests that we are numerically converged. But people have suggested, particularly Alex Lazarian and his collaborators have suggested that turbulent reconnection, which he likes to call reconnection diffusion, is a non-ideal process that can occur. And the point is that insofar as this is due to turbulence, then it's something that would be at least approximately included in our simulations. So that as we increase the resolution of our simulation, if it's a numerical artifact, then you would expect the numerical errors to go away as you improve your resolution. But if it's due to turbulence, what happens is, well, the effect just cascades down, and that's the physics that's doing that, and so it would continue to occur. So then what that has an implication because, if you remember earlier on, I had cited the Mestelin's picture argument, which said that GMCs have to form out of gas out of the diffuse interstellar medium that over a distance of a kiloparsec. And if you have a non-ideal effect like this, it's quite possible that you would not, you'd be able to form the gas instead of having this huge flow along the field lines, you would bring it in laterally as well as along the field lines. So, anyway.
Is it significantly better, like a factor of 2 or a factor of 10 or?
Well, that we're hoping to do is to determine that from our simulations, but we haven't done that yet. So in principle, it could be a factor of 10. So, okay, anyway, these are the conclusions. I'm running low on time. Let me quickly go to the protostellar accretion disk crisis. And the main point is that there are examples of protostars in the very earliest stage of their evolution which have a Keplerian disk. This was a summary of a number of protostars that had disks. At that time, they did not know whether they were rotating. They just knew that they had disks. But in a recent article, John Tobin and collaborators point that there are now, at least as of last year, there were 4 known rotationally supported accretion disks around these earliest stage of protostars. And the problem is the accretion disk crisis occurred because magnetic braking, as Mestel and Spitzer conjectured, can be so effective that it prevents the existence of disks. And since we exist and we think that we came from, we used to have a protostellar accretion disk around the sun, this is obviously not not correct. So the simulation then originally it was just a 2D simulation, and so it was ideal, it was not turbulent. And so anyway, there are many reasons why initially when this paper came out, I kind of dismissed it as saying, well, that, you know, as soon as you put in more physics, the problem will go away. Well, they put in more dimensions, and that didn't help. And then they went ahead and did non-ideal MHG. I was sure that was going to work. But now they've included ambipolar diffusion, Hall conductivity, and ohmic dissipation. And they confirmed the result that you cannot make large, you can make small disks, but not large ones. So a mechanism, though, that does seem to work is that if you have misalignment of the angular momentum in the magnetic field, has a big effect. And I should say that after they proposed this, this was subsequently observed by Chad Hull and collaborators. So here's the picture of one of their sources where you can see the outflow is going this way, and the magnetic field is kind of complicated, but it is clearly at some angle with respect to that. So they did a cumulative distribution of this angle. This is the projected angle between the outflow and the magnetic field. If they were aligned like all theorists believed, then this is, say, they're aligned to within 20 degrees, the data would have been up there. If it's random, it's a straight line, and you can see that, in fact, the data are a little bit below the straight line. So they don't regard this difference as significant, but it's certainly that there's very substantial misalignment.
That's from polarization measurements?
Yeah. And,
misalignment must start from the launching point, or?
Okay, that's a good question. You have to ask it, what scale is this?
Yeah,
because this is scale is 1,000 AU. So the amazing thing is that if you look at the alignment between, I think it's 1,000 AU and 100 parsecs, that's very good. Well, nobody plotted a graph like this, but it would be, that line would be up here someplace. And so between 1,000 AU and the outflow, which is presumably launched very near the star, is not very good. People now are doing alignment studies on smaller scales, and then I think the alignment gets better again. So anyway, and misalignment is expected in turbulent media. So what the simulations have shown by Hennebel and Chardy and their collaborators is that if you have 90 degree misalignment, then you can form a disk for a mass to flux ratio bigger than 3. Remember, 3 is a typical value. But if you have smaller misalignments, you need, you know, values of mass to flux ratio which are larger than are typical. So it's really not adequate if you do that just by itself. So turbulence, however, has a major effect. And the one effect is that it weakens the magnetic torque. You get misalignment naturally just due to the turbulence. And it also induces this reconnection diffusion or turbulent magnetic diffusivity. So almost no simulations with mass to flux ratios less than 10 and the angular momentum parallel to the magnetic field, but without turbulence, have produced disks, whereas almost all simulations that are well resolved with mass flux ratios bigger than 2 and moderate or strong turbulence have. And a couple of exceptions are that Machida et al. Did a simulation where they were able to get a large disk with a low mass to flux ratio from the collapsing Bonner-Ebert sphere. But this is a singular, at least as far as I can see, a singular result. No one else has found a result like that. So I don't understand why theirs is so different. Next question? That is for the non-ideal effects.
Yeah.
Yeah. For the turbulent misalignment and so forth, that's ideal. Then you don't. It doesn't. It's you know, ionization doesn't matter.
No. Yes.
Yeah. But in the non. Yeah. So then they for the non-ideal they vary the parameters a lot, and it just doesn't work.
It's the source of turbulence. So when core starts to collapse, the turbulence is gone, right?
No, the turbulence is always there. The Linewood size relation shows that the turbulence becomes weaker as you go to smaller scales, but it doesn't completely disappear.
Some of these cores are pretty narrow on the Linewood.
Yes, I think in the very center of the core, it disappears, but we're talking about scales. I don't know, the studies is a bit, the power is not here, but she did the studies in the, using lines that can prove the real center of this course. Actually, there is no evidence of this.
Well, I agree, it's subsonic turbulence.
Yes.
Yeah. At as you get in, but there's still some non-thermal motions.
So reconnection diffusion doesn't matter if it's subsonic?
For the reconnection diffusion, it does, it gets suppressed when it's subalphanic. So anyway, there's a big caveat here, which is that a couple of people that I cite there, including the Machida et al. Paper that I said I didn't understand, have done resolution studies, and when they go to higher resolution, they often get results which are inconsistent with the results. And so I have a whole paper describing what the answer is, and then they say, we double the resolution, and oops, we got a different answer. So I think it's a challenging problem. So anyway, so I have to go very quickly. And we did a simulation, and basically what we tried to do was to see how important misalignment was. So we took a turbulent system, and then we divided up into spherical shells, and we rotated the shell, each shell, so that now it was still turbulent, but all the turbulence was aligned, so that we could then have determined what the angle between the angular momentum in the turbulent medium was and the magnetic field. And we found that we never got a disk with that aligned turbulence. So and this was an example of one of our simulations, and you can see that with random turbulence, when we didn't do the alignment, and you can see that we got a fairly good Keplerian curve. And I don't have time to go through to just show how the breaking time, to form a disk, you want the breaking time over the freefall time to be large. And as Mostel and Paris showed long ago, that is directly proportional to the mass to flux ratio. So that's the governing parameter. So let me quickly go through that. And so these are conclusions on the magnetic flux problem. This was the question asked by Mostel and Spitzer long ago, and observations confirm what they conjectured, which is that it's subcritical. However, molecular cloud cores, which they didn't know existed, are supercritical. And GMCs are supercritical since they must have column densities to satisfy that criterion in order to become much denser than the ambient medium under the influence of gravity. So our driven turbulence simulations show that the mass to flux ratio in a turbulent medium increases more than expected in ideal MHT, possibly due to this reconnection diffusion or turbulent magnetic diffusivity. And that could contribute to resolving the magnetic flux problem. Ambipolar diffusion, we've seen no evidence that ambipolar diffusion is necessary. And we got a result for the mass-weighted total field, but we pointed out that the volume-weighted field actually increases with is smaller and increases with density less rapidly. And so we then concluded that the actual value of the mass to flux ratio in these molecular cores is about 3, so they are significantly magnetically supercritical. Then for the Angular-Menner problem, indeed the magnetic torques can solve the Angular-Menner problem, but they can't be too strong. And it appears that turbulence is absolutely essential. So only simulations that include turbulence are able to form protostellar accretion disk. And the misalignment of J and B is important. And we were unable to determine the importance of reconnection diffusion in this problem because we're using a sub-grid scale model for the treatment of the magnetic flux. So since we're doing ideal MHD, when we have a sink particle for the star and we accrete gas but not magnetic field, and that's artificial, so we can't really address that problem. So thank you.
Time for a few questions.
Just a historical question. So getting back to Lemon Spitzer, so he, of course, he knew eventually about molecular clouds.
Right.
So did it occur to him that they might be supercritical?
So I don't know. I think presumably in the second edition of his book, and that was,
79 or so.
Yeah, that was, he was writing that at about the time that I think Solomon came out and they had some, there was a conference where GMCs were first discovered, or discussed extensively, I think in the late 80s. Does anybody remember?
That.
I'm sorry, late 70s, pardon me, yeah, yes. Late 70s, at around the time he was writing his book. So I don't remember, he did not go into GMCs very much in the book. He did talk about molecules.
Yeah. So I have a very naive question perhaps. So you're saying you're doing ideal MHD simulations, mm-hmm. but then you said you have non-ideal effects arising.
Exactly.
So to me on phase, it seems that it has to be a numerical artifact. I don't understand how it's
going to
arise otherwise.
Okay, so what I'm trying to make the distinction between a numerical artifact, which in say a grid-based code or SPA, whatever you're doing, as you increase the resolution, then those numerical errors go away because they vary as some power of the grid size or your mass scale. On the other hand, if you have a physical effect, which is due to turbulence, that just cascades down. So if you know if you're trying to do incompressible turbulence, you do not have to put in any viscosity. You will still get a turbulent cascade. When you start getting close to the grid scale, then the numerical effects come in and distort it. But you can still, in principle, get a very nice inertial range, which is following the physics, even though you're completely messing up the small scale physics. And that's because it's cascading down. If you tried to do that, for example, in two-dimensional turbulence, then it wouldn't work because there the cascade is reversed and you go from small scales to large scales. So then,
but you're still solving the ideal MHD equation.
Exactly.
And, using
and then what happens, yeah, we're using constrained transport, but what happens is if, for example, you have oppositely directed fields and they happen to be advected into one grid cell, well, they're going to cancel. And that is a numerical effect, but that sort of mimics approximately.
Okay, that makes sense. Yeah. Thank you.
Sure.
Also, my question. Is it understood how you transition from subcritical to supercritical by sub-molecular lines?
Well, as the classical view is, in fact, that it is just flow along field lines, and then Lazarian has been pushing the idea that this non-ideal effect would enable you to do that.
Okay. In terms of turbulence.
Yeah. Now, I should say, of course, that Mestel and Spitzer and Mushabias, if Ptolemaeus were here today, he would insist that it, of course, is all ambipolar diffusion. But he would say, in his picture, as I understand it, even molecular cores initially form magnetically subcritical, and then when they're self-gravitating, they undergo this long period of ambipolar diffusion and become supercritical. But as I said, there's no evidence for that. Yeah.
Then there's no formalism.
But on the scale of the GMCs, we're coming up to this point, the transition from subcritical to supercritical clouds. I think what you're saying is you're pushing, I mean, you are saying that there must be more of these flows occurring along large-scale field lines, and to my knowledge, there's not much evidence for kinematically those flows.
Well, how do the GMCs, the GMCs clearly form from flows. There's overall a compression. And as you know, if some people go so far as to say that star formation, in fact, is due to these flows, and then they set up colliding flows where they have two beams of gas going at each other.
We do those simulations in Amber group most recently, but when you put in the field such as colliding subcritical flows, nothing happens, as you'd expect. So to get gravitationally bound clouds.
Well, wait, but if they, if you have, if the flow is along the field lines, and you then bring in material from a kiloparsec, it will become supercritical, and then you can form stars. I agree. Other than
at least the simulations I've seen, I can't remember all the geometries now. So
sure.
Robbie Banerjee and his students.
Right.
I think from a range of geometries, they basically find it's very difficult to form stars and bound clouds in such converging flow situations. So I think it's still an issue how you get this H1 to GMC transition.
No, I agree with you as to whether, I'm saying that since I don't, well, even Telemachus doesn't argue that's to damped-pole diffusion.
There's a simple argument that
sure.
I think Elmgren was making. I mean, you look at N51, you look at the spiral line, you see that the transition from non-molecular to molecular is almost like instant. And just that it's not a kiloparsec, it's not a hyperparsec, it's very, very narrow region. So you see gas gets compressed to a spiral wave and not the molecular. And you see star formation with two layers. So there's no room for collecting anything for parsecs, etc. You see this, you see spiral arm, which is a density, just lighten up here and here, all along the spiral arm, right? So you know that molecular forms, clouds form, and then stars form, and then very, very quickly after it has
Yeah, so what I don't know, the M51 has a higher mean density than the Milky Way, so I used the, as Jonathan said, when he was describing these results, if the gas is magnetically subcritical, it's not going to form stars. So the fact that he does get the star formation occurring fairly quickly suggests that what the molecular gas is magnetically supercritical. And so it's you get the compression, so you start off with a higher mean density, and that then you get a large compression when it goes through the density wave shock. And Bruce is measuring the distance of the shock gas. Furthermore, as you know, when you go through the shock is, the post-shock flow is almost tangent, I think, to the arm. So that you actually have, so the distance perpendicular to the arm is short, but the distance that the, if you follow the particle, I think it goes a much longer distance. Yeah.
So why don't we continue this later? So
sure.
Again, let me know if you're coming for dinner this evening. Probably go to Leeds Beach Cafe. Raise your hands again one more time, just have a quick count. Okay. And then let's thank Chris again.